Hello and welcome to the Undercut Podcast. I'm your host, Jesse Billington, and we are back to review the seventh round of the 2025 Formula One season, the Imola Grand Prix. To do this, I'm joined by Mr. Timo Albers-Daly. How are you?
Bemused, Mr. Billington, because once again, we've gone into a Grand Prix weekend expecting the square root of Sodor. And we've come out of the side with a surprisingly decent Grand Prix. And it reminds me very much of Mexico from last year, going, oh, we might not be getting it again for a good while. And then it uncharacteristically delivers quite a decent Grand Prix by its own standards. And everyone's just left afterwards scratching their heads going, so do we renew it or do we look at that as a nice finale swan song for the time being? And hopefully it doesn't get renewed for like 20 years or something silly just because it's had one good Grand Prix in five. But that being said, it was an enjoyable Grand Prix, but it's just left a lot of baffled feelings within many a person, I think.
Yeah, I thought I was being a bit ambitious when I titled the sort of preview episodes of like sort of if it is to this one being a good one or something. I was like, perhaps that's a bit ambitious, we'll get a good Imola. But turns out we did, really, which was a pleasant surprise.
It took a while for the weekend to get there. Everything up to that point did indicate we weren't going to get anything interesting, and the feeder series weren't pulling their weight either. So it's not as if we didn't have some merit in our slightly downbeat predictions.
Our apprehension. Yeah, usually when you get a dull Formula 3 and a dull Formula 2, you're like, oh,
doesn't bode well.
Doesn't bode well, yeah. But we did very very well, really, in the grand scheme of things. And we'll dig into that in a second. We'll kick off with the important news, because, of course, across the Sunday, it was qualifying day for the Indy 500. And I want to touch on this, because it is quite impressive.
Qualifying weekend.
Yes,
they just make it extra.
It's Indy 500 month, I think, is the best way of describing it.
It is. It's the month of May.
It is the month of May. It is speed month. And Robert Schwartzman has taken pole for the Indy 500. And this is a phenomenal effort, really, for a rookie driver. The first time a rookie has taken pole at the Indy 500 since Teo Fabi in 1983. It's worth noting this is also Prema's first season in the sport. This is Robert's first outing at a Super Bowl. It's Prema's first outing doing any of these sort of big speedway tracks. It's so many firsts. It's just incredible. And this isn't like he was handed it because of the Penske penalties. This was outright pace. This was just raw talent.
He did all of this before that even got there, to be perfectly honest. He didn't need any help. And it's just so curious because up until this point in the season, he has been nowhere. I mean, his car tried to kill him in Thermal Club. He's had Grand Prix weekends where he's had very little practice, and the only kind of time he's had in the car around the track has been in qualifying before the race itself. And then, as you say, out of nowhere, on his first appearance at an oval, sticks on pole for one of the biggest races in motorsport. Not too shabby. And also just to show you how kind of wacky this race is set up to be for next weekend. You obviously got Robert Schwartzman, rookie, for a brand new team, like you say, on one side of the grid. Young driver himself, kind of not the youngest, but again, fairly young. And I think also the youngest pole sitter since 1984 or something as well. So breaking or kind of setting a new kind of benchmark there in some respects. But on the other side of it, you've got Takuma Sato in second place, who this is his one IndyCar race of the year.
He's like 40 something, isn't he?
He's in his mid-40s. Just decides I'm going to turn up for this and just stuck it on provisional pole pretty early on in the fast six. And then Schwartzman comes out of nowhere and goes, I'll take that. Thank you very much. And you combine those two storylines with the fact that Alex Palou is a bit out of position. Team Penske, as you say, are self-destructing. They've got a start at the back after a modified attenuator was discovered on their car because everyone now scrubbing going, what the hell's a modified attenuator? Because we never had to deal with these before. The strategists have been suspended for the race. Their quality points have been taken away from them. Both cars have been fined $100,000. And then you throw in the fact that drivers like Kyle Larson, Helio Castroneves, and Marco Andretti are also in this race. And you go, I'm quite glad it's not on at exactly the same time as Monaco, because I'm quite wonder what it goes back to back.
Yeah, this is certainly going to be an Indy 500 to watch. And modified attenuator, essentially what it is it's the tail parts of like the gearbox that sticks out where your rear jackman gets on. And what Penske had done was sort of essentially used a little bit of Bondo and filler just to smooth off the layer where two panels join together, and they sort of panels overlap. So you have this sort of dirty flat edge that over 500 miles at high speed would cause a bit of drag. It would increase your fuel load. It would increase your aerodynamic resistance. It would be a potential advantage. And the problem is it's a part that you can't modify.
It's quite interesting, though, the fact that it was only on two of the three cars, and the third car in question was one that absolutely destroyed on Saturday by Scott McLaughlin when he was pressing with it. So just all kinds of question marks, and it's the second year in a row now that Penske have had controversial happenings going on within the team at the start of a season. So I don't know what's going on there, but absolutely fascinating. And I was fully prepared for qualifying alone to be more interesting than the Formula One at Imola, but mercifully, we got some interesting stuff to happen at Imola in places on the track as well that we wouldn't have thought we'd have gotten either. So surprisingly pleasant Sunday in terms of racing action there when you look at those two alone before you even move to anything else.
The driver sort of getting used to the size of these cars and the lack of size of Imola and sort of finding some different spots to get cars past one another. I know that usually the overtaking spot in Imola is either along that sort of front pit straight where you can sort of use the DRS to get past or use the overspeed into turn one into Tamburello. But there's also the second chicane that follows Tamburello, which Lando Norris found a fairly nice little way past George Russell there eventually, sold him the dummy into Tamburello, compromised his line, and had an interesting run. Speaking of Norris, we might as well jump into our team-by-team analysis. There's no change in the team's order this weekend, so we'll kick off with, is there?
Were Mercedes ahead of Red Bull last week?
Checks notes, maybe I'm wrong there. I was going completely by memory there. Mercedes were ahead
might have been.
Of Red Bull last week, and they're ahead of Red Bull this week. Mercedes are still in second.
Oh, okay. I thought they were in third up until this point.
No.
I did wonder how they managed to get ahead of Red Bull because of the weekend they had, but no, fair enough. Miami is such a long time ago.
Mercedes have been in second since the start of the season.
I just completely snoozed all of that.
Yeah, Mercedes have been in second, Red Bull have been in third the entire season. Ferrari started in seventh, made their way
no
to...
No idea what happened there.
Since. So, yeah, there we go. Anyway, McLaren starting at the top and working our way down. Piastri qualified it on pole. Norris qualified fourth, with Piastri going on to take P3 and Norris P2 by the checkered flag.
Piastri is going to be frustrated with what happened on the opening lap, but he's also going to have already moved on. He's going to have looked at it, analysed it, and he'll have learned. He's not a driver that's going to let that land the negative momentum fester and develop. He's already over it, and it's frustrating as a P3 is, especially behind his teammate who started behind him. He's going to learn from that, and we know the kind of driver that he is, and that's it, and that's all. Norris had an interesting weekend, I think. He was pretty anonymous for the most part, but I don't think, as is often the case when you're anonymous in F1, in a good car, that's not the worst thing in the world. I mean, look at George Russell all season, pretty much. He did struggle again, though, with getting past drivers not as quickly as perhaps would have been expected. You mentioned him getting past George Russell with a tidy move, but it did take him a good few attempts to do it, and you just kind of piece that together with other moves earlier in the season. You look at the obvious example of him trying to get past Hamilton in Saudi Arabia. You go, why is this taking you so long? You know the tracks, you know the drivers that you're going up against, you know, the cars that they're in. You should have an idea at this point. So that was interesting for me, I think. And also just the McLaren strategy, because it did work out for him in the end. And that's probably not the worst thing in the world in terms of showing the equal treatment argument is still very much there. Piastri isn't going to be as fussed about it because he finished in third, and we'll get onto this later with some other drivers as well, but he's probably quite happy there weren't a few extra laps and the safety car was out for as long as it was, because otherwise that may have been a bit different. But I think we're getting to the point now where we're running out of time for them to not make decisions where it may have to start favouring one or the other, purely just to try and keep the peace a little bit. You look at Mercedes in 14, 15, 16 is the kind of obvious build-up of that over a period of time, and how well and how unwell that went at times. So we're not there yet, but there were definitely teasers of that, I think. And They're still behaving, but we're getting close to the point where something is going to happen.
Yeah, there's going to be a breaking point soon between those two drivers. And yeah, I think Piastri's right to be a little bit disappointed. It's strange that it's another race weekend, however, where the strategy doesn't fall his way when it comes to safety cars. I think this isn't necessarily just sort of a that's how McLaren are playing. I think it's just a case of McLaren are still figuring out how to sort of strategize for this current style of race, where you have one stop and that is it.
And being in this position with two cars, because they're still woefully under experienced in this in recent times with this setup.
There's a lot for McLaren to sort of learn at the moment, and I think I can forgive them for it. They're learning. They're doing very well with what they're learning so far. It's not like they're really sort of dropping the ball as they go, but there's a lot of development still to be done at Woking, but their drivers are still pushing really well, and it's definitely getting exciting. The two drivers are close on track, and they're still being allowed to race, and they're racing cleanly and fairly. They're not unduly holding one another.
They're being polite about it so far, because we know Piastri can be incredibly aggressive. He didn't show that as much as he would have done were it someone else. Norris, I don't know if we've ever seen him drive properly aggressive against another person and succeed. So again, maybe he's being a little cautious as well, on top of the fact that it's his teammate. But again, that's not going to last long, because it never does.
Yeah. I think the interesting side too, you mentioned George Russell sort of at the start of it as well. I think George was not annoyed at Piastri for like blocking him or something. I think he was annoyed at Piastri for simply not defending hard enough against Verstappen, because I think George felt that possibly if he was in that same situation, he would have just come off the brakes a little bit earlier and closed the gap for Verstappen, knowing he had the inside line and therefore control of the corner. So I think it was an interesting one, but also at the same time, Piastri knows he's in the championship lead. He knows that it will take more than a couple of, a lot more than a few race weekends of finishing just behind Norris
It's the Alex Palou argument. Even if you don't finish first, if you're coming second or third, you're still fine, because you need the other person to still come first every single time to stand a chance of beating you, and that's not happening yet.
Yeah, he knows that he's sort of got this points advantage on track, and he can drive carefully and he can drive cleverly, and
he doesn't need to risk it as much.
Yeah, there was, I think it was a great sort of saying or sort of work ethic by Jackie Stewart in his period. He said the best way to win a Grand Prix is as slowly and carefully as possible. And that is sort of very much the approach that Oscar Piastri is taking. And the fact that he's like, I will get there, I'll be on the podium, I'll take in the maximum points with the minimum risk. And the net result so far is actually proving it sort of working. And yeah, I think he can keep it. For him, Australia is the only race outing so far where he's not been in the top three come the checkered flag, which is a really good sign of his consistency. I think Lando produced a far better race this weekend than his qualifying suggested he might. Really calm, very well-metered approach.
Like I said, the anonymous nature served him well. Yes. It was good that we didn't see him or hear him. It was like, good, this is kind of what you need to do. We don't want to see or hear you, because it's kind of like Verstappen in 23, obviously nowhere near that level, but you know what I mean, in the sense of we barely ever saw him because he was just getting on with the job in hand. It was Leclerc last year, Russell for points this year. You don't see them, they're getting on with it.
Yes, yeah. I mean, we say about Russell every weekend that he just sort of does nothing, gets P3. And weekend should have been another one of those, but
if it wasn't for that meddling safety car.
Yeah, if it wasn't for that meddling safety car, and there was something wasn't right at Mercedes this weekend. It was the first weekend where Toto Wolff was completely hands-off. Usually, if he's not actually at the race, he's got a remote station that he can sort of control and sort of oversee.
I do like the idea of him having that pinned down ass. It will just, wherever he is in the world, just sets it up really quickly. You're just down in the middle of a shopping mall, and like, oh, race. Da-da-da-da-da. I've got to focus here for 2 hours, or just in the middle of a park.
Sort of like a pop-up tent sort of thing. He just sort of throws it in a little pouch and it's
have to assemble your own mini pit box in five easy steps.
Yeah, and I don't know. I don't want to put it down to something as simple as that, because I believe Mercedes are polished enough as a unit to be able to work past those issues. But there was, Russell was Consistency was really put to the try against challenging conditions in Imola. The car wasn't under him. I don't know if it was the heat, the type of the tarmac, the fact they're on the very soft tyres. I was curious as well to the reason behind that strange feeling rear end. I don't know if the heat was affecting the bushes in the suspension that were giving us different spring and roll rates that were just causing it to be a bit more unsettled. And then Kimi Antonelli, unfortunately, retiring at home. And when you look at the sort of issues that drivers are having at their home Grand Prix.
I was about to say it's quite amusing where the Leclerc curse dies in 2024, revives in 2025. So Nelly at Imola, and you go, oh no,
yeah,
we're in for another one of these, aren't we?
Yeah, because obviously Piastri spins out, gets stuck in the mud at his home race. Did Tsunoda have a terrible one in Japan?
He didn't finish in the points, I don't think.
Finished the points, though, on his Red Bull debut.
In his Red Bull debut, so we can argue that it's terrible, yeah. Right?
We haven't heard any other home races until we then obviously got to Imola, which didn't go well for Antonelli. So, yeah.
We should have known, really, that it wasn't going to go well for him when he invited his entire class to come and watch him. It's kind of thing, watch this. Oh, sort of thing. And at least he didn't destroy his car into a billion pieces. But it's also curious that of all the weekends for it to happen, it's also the weekend where for the first time this season Russell finishes outside the top five for the first time this year. And I think a bit like Antonelli and Bahrain, Mercedes as a whole just weren't there, and they weren't going to be there every weekend. And I think this is simply an example of that, but I don't believe it's anything really to worry about. It's just sometimes it's not going to peter through for you. And okay, unfortunately for Antonelli, that he's gotten the worst end of the stick so far in terms of it with what I think a P11 or a P12 in Bahrain and now a DNF. And Russell's bad day is what a P7. But it's still not too shabby. And it's not going to happen every weekend. So I think it's just, that is just racing. And it's weirdly nice to have that reliability element come back into it. With we had that a couple of races ago, I think, and we were all pleasantly kind of surprised by that in terms of, it's a shame that reliability has happened here, but it's nice because we haven't had reliability be an issue for so long that we couldn't rely on it to make the race a little bit more interesting. And it did make this interesting. And because it was reliability, it was a natural way of it. It wasn't, you know, Singapore 2008, we'll make it interesting that way, and that sort of thing. Or let's have a sprint race for no apparent reason to try and make it interesting. It's just racing.
Yeah, it wasn't a sort of forced hand of reliability. It was a sort of genuine issue. There was an airflow issue for Esteban Ocon. I can't remember what the problem was for Kimi Antonelli. I think it was a throttle sensor issue that meant basically there was just no control over the engine. But yeah, the reliability sort of coming back in, it spices things up. I don't think that the ultra soft tyres were the way to go this weekend because they just weren't used, ultimately. Drivers are even finding that in qualifying, like I predicted in the preview, that you wouldn't be able to get a full lap out of the soft tyres because they were just too soft and were gone by the end of the lap. So a lot of
the curious thing is the second time this has happened to me this year in two different series, and it's just it happened more than once. I'd have two nickels, and it's not much, but it's weird that I've got two nickels. We had this in Thermal Club with IndyCar. They had these tyres, and I was laughing on Team Radio going, this isn't even lasting a whole lap. Why are we using these? What's going to happen tomorrow? And everyone's going, yeah, we're not sure why we've got these either, to be honest, but rules are rules. We've got to get on with it.
Yeah, it's just sort of baffling that Pirelli brought out these tyres and were like, this is going to revolutionise the way we race because they're going to be soft and we're going to get a super lap speed and we're going to get the ability to overtake in locations you don't think of. And ultimately, it just meant that the tyres weren't actually going to last a lap. And the net result was they just weren't used. Even in qualifying, we had drivers swapping to the medium tyre and getting better lap times out of it.
Which I always find bemusing because it makes sense, but it doesn't at the same time. And it's one of those just brilliant things.
Yeah, if you understand the very little of how F1 tyres work, you go, well, that doesn't make sense. And as soon as you understand a bit more about how an F1 tyre works, you go, actually, that makes an incredible amount of sense because I need a tyre to
last. I just love the amount of immediate confusion you can get out of it by going, the softer, the quicker, and then you put on slower tyre, and you go, hey.
Yeah.
And just everyone goes, wait a minute, we need to look more into tyres, and then we send them to what we hope at some point Eddie May's going to make a long 90-minute podcast by herself just on tyres.
She will do eventually. We will get to that point where we do perhaps sort of as a mid-season sort of filler to what in the summer break we'll talk about tyres. But I think we've sort of run out of talking points about Mercedes. So we'll move on to Red Bull, who very much had a weekend of two halves as they celebrated 400 races.
Got to say, Verstappen's overtake into turn two on the first lap was just simply one of the best overtakes I've ever seen. It was measured, it was ballsy, and classically Verstappen. He didn't need to get overly aggressive or controversial. He just went for a gap, made it work, and nobody could fault him for it. And I don't think even Oscar could, because if he'd anticipated that there was even a chance in his mind that it was doable, he would have blocked it. And it does show a little bit of an experience there, because obviously the experience differential between the two of them are quite vast. But it's one where I think it's whenever you see Verstappen or Hamilton or Alonso kind of do a move on each other and it works. And it was just quite nice. It's kind of like Piastri whenever he overtook Hamilton in Australia or in Saudi. Hamilton's annoyed, but he's also kind of smirking a little bit inside the helmet going, that was a nice move, to be fair. I would like, it's cheeky, but I like it.
Mm. I think the thing with the Verstappen overtake through that opening sector is go back and watch it. I think someone has compiled an offboard of a Verstappen on board, the Piastri on board, and the Russell on board. And the Russell on board is the one you really want to notice, because for a brief moment, actually, Russell's got the lead over Verstappen. Verstappen hasn't got a start as you think he has, but through the second phase of the start, he really comes back.
Yeah, so it's very close.
You're Russell thinking, okay, what I need to do is I need to be able to move over and close off a bit of the gap on Verstappen and hope Piastri does the same, and then the two of us will be able to pull away. But that's obviously why Russell got annoyed with Piastri, is the fact that he doesn't, but also the fact that Verstappen just comes out of nowhere on the brakes, makes it past two people, makes the apex for the second part of the Tamburello chicane.
And he just looks on rails the whole time, as if it was the obvious thing he was always going to do. And it did remind me very much of, have you gone back to 2021 and watched what Lewis is trying to do to you? And obviously, without the clambering onto the curbs and slight floor damage, and goes, I liked what he was trying there. Let me give it a go in the dry. And then just makes it work. And then from then on, it was never in doubt. I mean, even at the end, where off the safety car, you had a smattering of laps left, and you had, 5-6 seconds up the road by the end of it, and you go, yeah, of course. It's like Pelot last week in Santiago again. You've had this bunch up, and then you've got about 10 laps, and he's about 16 seconds up the road. You're going, how did you manage that?
Yeah, I love the fact that we're seeing a driver who we thought to be at their absolute peak, who is still learning and developing and getting sort of stronger. And every weekend, he just sort of pulls out this additional little bit, and we sort of left going, oh, wow.
It's almost better that he doesn't have the best car, because it allows him to not need to be a defending champion in the traditional sense. He's fighting for the championship, but I don't think he believes as much as he would before that it's on the cards. It's a tricky one, because obviously he believes he can do it and he believes he's capable, but there's a realism that maybe crept in a little bit as well. But it's working well for him, because a little bit like Piastri, he knows that he'll go for it when he gets the opportunity. When he doesn't, it's okay, because you're not in the best car anyway. It's going to be trickier, and I've also got four titles. I don't need to prove anything. But he can just afford to risk it a bit more, because if it goes wrong, well, he's not necessarily winning anyway, so it doesn't matter. So it's this curious thing of Oscar's driving very measured and very sensibly. And like you say, if he's not first, he's still third, you know? And that's enough to do when your main rival's only just a little bit ahead of you. They can get more points, but not enough to be able to close the gap to you. And you're going to keep winning. Max is also doing this kind of measured approach of, I'm already won more Grand Prix this year than I was expecting to, and I'm doing better than I arguably should be, considering McLaren's and the business going there. Meanwhile, you've got Norris going, what do I do with any of this? And it's the momentum not being carried through. And it's all just a bit awkward. Like, do you have the measured approach? Okay, it's not going to work. Could you be aggressive? Oh, that's not quite working either. And he's in this awkward no man's land of, he's not necessarily doing anything wrong, but he needs to do something else. And it's causing some interesting headaches for him, and it's causing interesting headaches for other drivers who want to take on Piastri and Verstappen, even if they're not going for the title, just for the sake of we can fight you because we have the opportunity to.
Sort of Norris is stuck, like you said, a bit of a sort of a no man's land and sort of figuring out what to do. But Verstappen is able to just sort of not sit back, but just sort of revel in having a far more successful championship than I think he anticipated. He knew how to make the overall strategy of this weekend work. He knew that clean air and space were key to really getting the most out of it, especially in the heat, knowing that the Red Bull can't control its tyre temperature like the McLaren can. And he was able to pull out that gap that he might need if he had to shovel Piastri wide for the lead, like we sort of saw him potentially try and do in Saudi, where thought sort of if I cut it, I'll just sort of disappear and get a 5 second gap. But he didn't even need to think about it.
Just did it.
For Yuki, though, it was a simple mistake in qualifying with disastrous consequences. Imola bites hard when it does. But his recovery to the top 10, I think, is definitely worth mentioning because it was sublime, really, around a circuit where you cannot overtake. Huge credit to Red Bull for being able to strategize a pit lane to points race around Imola for Yuki.
For once,
for getting the strategy right, and also for Yuki for being able to pull it off. So I think it's a really clean and concerted effort and a great example of what Red Bull does best, which is sort of manage disasters, turn it around well, and sort of think a bit differently to make the most of a situation. But also when they're firing on all cylinders, as you see with Max, they're able to produce these absolutely stellar performances. So you had sort of both worlds of Red Bull at its sort of 400th anniversary race. Worth pointing out, the 400 races as a team, Max has won 65 of those, so just over 16%. And as a team, they have 124 wins this century, putting them ahead of Ferrari on 123 and Mercedes on 120. McLaren, for reference, have 71 wins this century. Max also now matches Michael Schumacher's second place for the most podiums with one team, 116 with Red Bull. Schumi is the same with Ferrari. Lewis, however, still holds the outright record of 153 with Mercedes. So again, it'll
take a few more years for him to do something on that one if he wants to.
Yeah, it's going to take another, even if he podiums in every race for what did I say it was on 116, he's going to basically have to podium for every race this year, every race next year, and then the half of every race in 2027. But he might be long gone in GT3 racing by then. But he's not here for the statistics, he's here to do what he did this weekend, which is have a really damn good motor race.
The thing that's interesting with Red Bull, a little bit, as I was saying, with Verstappen, but as a whole, when they're not at the top, maybe it's doing them a little bit of good because the pressure is off in some ways. They'd probably argue the pressure's on even more because they've got to get back to the top. But for how they were able to handle Yuki with giving him a good strategy and with how Verstappen's approach with his strategy and his racecraft as well gave them the better result than perhaps they were expecting, especially after Yuki destroyed a significant portion of the car in qualifying. You always go, it'd be nice for point, but yeah. And you could argue that the DNF from Antonelli helped him there, because if it wasn't there, I couldn't see him getting past it. And I was a bit surprised that Alonso wasn't able to get past him in the closing stages of the race. I mean, we know the Etemad was improved, didn't have the race pace, we get to him later, but it was, I don't want to say luck, but there was definitely some, there was luck combined with good strategy, which sometimes you need to make the good strategy work even more, which, fair enough, you've got to take the opportunity where you can, so I'm not going to fault him or the team for that. I don't know if I'm convinced as yet for Yuki to be in that seat compared to Perez and Lawson, but as I think I said before, I'll wait to discuss that properly in the summer break when there's a, because unlike Red Bull, I'm going to wait for a bit more data before making some big decisions there. I think it is perhaps probably be a bit more difficult for him so far than he may have thought. But that being said, his result there this weekend after the back of such a big crash, he probably isn't happy, but is happier than he might have been, especially if he'd just got P11, say, and could say he'd been reversed with Alonso and he could see Alonso 0.6 of a second or whatever just ahead of him off the road. He'd have been one of those drivers ruining that the safety car was out for a few laps longer than that needed to be.
Yeah, he sort of, I think Yuki made the most of his strategy and also was very fortunate to get quite lucky with it as well. So sort of six of one, half a dozen the other, but either way, it was a double points finish for Red Bull in a weekend where, when coming out of qualifying, they had one car on the front row, one car that was actually just in the scrap heap at that point. They had to go and get the spare tub out of the lorry and build up an entirely new car. So, yeah, congratulations to Red Bull mechanics for the turnaround there. Meanwhile, speaking of a turnaround, Ferrari, Hamilton qualified 12th, Leclerc qualified 11th, and then Hamilton having a fairly good weekend, actually, for his first home race in front of the Tifosi, P4, and Leclerc a slightly begrudged P6.
I don't mind Ferrari qualifying terribly if this is what they can do in the Grand Prix. They're tricky in Monaco, especially if they do this and go, Christ, you made it difficult for yourself, but it's possible. A bit like Norris, I was sort of surprised it took Hamilton so long to get past Antonelli, especially after Ben Antonelli. But when he did, it was a bit like Ferrari teased themselves to be back in Bahrain. There was that, we do know what we're doing, sort of an element to things. And it was nice to see Ferrari Wars wake up a bit. It's another piece here of could have done with the safety car coming in a bit sooner, because Hamilton was getting very close to Piastri at the end. He was chomping down the gap. And ooh, could you imagine if he'd managed to get a podium at his first home Grand Prix for Ferrari in Imola, especially if Imola was then just not on the calendar for a few years. That would have been hell of a send-off. But that being said, I don't think he would have been too unhappy with it, and it was quite nice to see that coming together. Leclerc was quite angry. But he was on a charge throughout the entire Grand Prix, which I love to see. We need a bit more of that sort of Charles. We need that Charles married with the Charles we saw at the start of 2022 when he was fighting Max consistently. We need that clean and methodical method with a bit of anger. That's the right combination, I think. And I loved how he could force some drivers into mistakes, such as Gasly. He just kind of, I'm not going to tell you to go over into the gravel, but I'm going to make a suggestion for you to go into the gravel too. I can get past easier. And he did. And it was just nice to see that kind of 4D thinking in some ways of, I'm already plotting my next thing, so the thing I'm doing right now, it's going to confuse you and you're going to fall for it because I'm going to screw over here instead and there's nothing you can do about it because I'm looking at the ground and I'm ahead of you. And also, my teammate can get past you as well now, which is just a nice bonus. It was a shame we couldn't keep the P5 at the end, but I think there's some other reason we should have had another few laps because it would have been... I think the decision could have come a little bit sooner from either the team or the fact that it was being investigated and all the rest of it. And if we had more laps, he might have been able to then get back past Albon, which already Albon will be happy that that wasn't the case. But Leclerc is going to be another one of those drivers where it wasn't a terrible result considering where he started, but considering what he had in front of him at that point, a little frustrating, I'd say.
Yeah, I think the opportunity that was there for Leclerc was a bit of an annoying one, let's say. But for Lewis, yeah, strongest GP result. And coming to it from outside the points at Ferrari's home race, a bit of poetry. I think the Tifosi will be happy that that's the result he was able to produce from it. I think Charles was right when it came to that final pit stop strategy, though, as he needed fresh tyres to do better against Albon. And he was right that a soft would make it to the end, as it was only 10 laps to go by the time the safety car came in. And the Ferrari pit wall said to him, Charlotte will only do 11. And he was like, I will not need it to go the full distance because we will do more laps on the safety car, because he could see that they were taking their time to recover Antonelli. And yeah, obviously there was that sort of slightly scrappy moment with Alex later on. I think it was wise to swap back with him as the penalty would have dropped him even further back. So an unfortunate result for him. But again, if that's what Ferrari's race pace is like, they didn't have their orders right when it came to qualifying. They made some mistakes there. So it's just sort of that case of if Ferrari can get their weekends together a bit more, there's...
Monaco is going to be very interesting because that'd be the perfect time to sort your qualifying out.
Yeah, a very good weekend to sort your qualifying
out. Or alternatively, if you do bin your qualifying off with the mandatory two stops that we're going to have for Monaco, perfect opportunity to get that strategy right and look like an absolute bunch of heroes.
Yeah, if they're able to do something about it when it comes to the strategy, we'll be saying different things about Ferrari by the end of the Monaco Grand Prix. But all in, it's a decent weekend for them. It's an even better weekend, however, for Williams. Alex Albon qualified 7th, while his teammate Carlos Sainz qualified just ahead of him in 6th. But when it came to the finishing order, it was Albon with another Q P5 and Carlos Sainz finishing again in the points P8.
really coming together for this team, and you just love to see the resurgence. There's no one who is unhappy with this. I mean, I know people keep liking to poke the stick of, oh, look at Carlos doing better than Ferrari. And it's like, yeah, but we don't need that, because it's just, can we just enjoy the fact that Carlos is doing well in a Williams, like we all wanted him to, because we all suspected that we weren't going to get that, at least not this soon. It was kind of, this is a project. We're going to get there in 26 or 27, but it's going to be a painful year. So hopefully we're not into that in reverse, but let's just enjoy the fact that we're getting what we actually wanted for a minute. And I think my latest prediction for this season will be that when Ferrari get past Red Bull in the constructor standings, if Williams keep going like this, Red Bull could fall as far back as fifth if they're not careful, because Williams have two drivers working for them, whilst Red Bull are still kind of fighting one-handed. And if you need double points finishes, you're going to need better than 10th or 9th to be your second driver scoring there, whereas Williams, they're kind of like the Verstappen against McLaren in this instance. They're just going to yeet it up there because they can, they've got nothing to lose. And also, they're not guaranteed fifth, but they're pretty comfortable there. So if they get the chance to go for fourth, why not? I don't know if it'll happen, but I can get very close towards the end of the season. One bad race for Red Bull. I mean, arguably for Verstappen at the moment, because Yuki's not quite there to be in the position that Verstappen would be in if he wasn't. So one bad race for Verstappen could change a lot on that one.
Okay.
I don't think anyone would be too disappointed to see Williams somehow hit Red Bull, especially if you go back 12 months ago. Guess what's going to happen next year? And you go,
I mean, Williams at the moment on 51 points, Red Bull 131 points, so 80 points the difference.
It's going to take a bit of time.
Yeah, it's going to be a slow burn. But if you look at the way that Williams have comfortably been sort of pulling away from Haas below them, Haas on 20 points, Aston Martin on 14, RB 10, Sauber and Alpine, I think, are still tied on 6 apiece, if my mathematics...
Not scored any points right recently, so I don't know why it would have changed.
Alpine 7, Sauber 6, sorry. So, yeah, I think Williams are in a strong position, really, on 51 points, and I think they'll be... they'll be happy to capitalize on that. They've clearly got pace in the car. They've got drivers that now understand the car as well. And I think they're just sort of figuring out, a bit like McLaren, they're figuring out their strategy and how they actually run their race. Because for the first time, Williams have got two competitive drivers in a car that can be competitive as well. Whereas previously they've been like, we've got a car that's mid with one good driver in it and Logan Sargeant. And sort of now they've got to figure out how to do strategies for two quite good drivers. And it's a similar thing we're sort of seeing a bit with Ferrari, is them sort of figuring out strategy, seeing McLaren figuring out how you do your strategy a bit. And it's a learning curve. And I'm enjoying watching Williams on it, because they're being very honest about their learning and how they're going about it and what they're doing to change things and move things forward, which is...
Big Bells are still doing his post-Grand Prix chats where it's like, this is what happened today and why we did what we did. It's like, thank you, James. That's what we needed, Robbie.
Yeah, it's a level of openness that you don't really get from many others, but it makes it really easy to be supportive or engaged with them as a team. And that is, for me, quite a nice thing.
I do feel like someone's offered you one of these kind of Matrix-style pills, though, and go, okay, so this year you can have Yuki and Red Bull, but they're going to finish in P5 and the constructors behind Williams. You're going, damn, that is kind of a nice trade-off.
Yeah. That I would take that pill. If someone had offered it to me, I would take that pill. Because I think that we're getting to see Yuki really pushing himself to perform, and we're seeing some interesting results from that. But mostly I like seeing Williams come back in my heart of hearts. I just can't hate that.
It feels all right.
Yeah. Worth noting as well, I did a bit more maths and history digging. Alex is on 40 points so far. This is his third best season ever, and obviously we're not that far into this season at all. He has just over 78% of Williams' tally overall this season, and he's only finished outside the top 10 once this season and has beaten Carlos 8-1 across the board. So he's doing really nicely and is possibly on track to beat one of his Red Bull points hauls across a season in a Williams. So, yeah, this is good territory for Alex Albon. Meanwhile, not having such a good time, Haas. Ocon qualified 18th and Behrman qualified 19th, annoyingly with a time deleted because it was deemed to have been set just as the red flag was flown. Ocon would then DNF and Behrman would come home P17.
Silver lining for me here is that I'm quite impressed that it took this long for Haas to have their first DNF of the season, which when Ocon retired, I thought, and they said about that, I thought, no, that can't be right, surely. And then I thought back and I'm like, what? Well, that's true. Fair enough. Well, good on you. Behrman, unfortunate, but oh well.
Yeah, just sort of a bit of a flat bag, really, for Haas this weekend. A lot to learn from. I don't know, they were fighting hard to have Behrman's qualifying time reinstated so he could go out in Q2. I don't get why.
It's just quite, I find it so amusing because I know obviously why it is the way it is, but I always find it amusing when you have a situation like this where you've got kind of, oh, it is a time getting deleted for whatever reason so that a different driver can go. Meanwhile, then you get to Q2 and Franco Colapinto's there. You go, that dude's not even there because his car's in about 6,000 pieces. Why not just take him out, put Behrman in, and we'll just leave it and keep everyone happy that way?
Because also, I need to check like all the raw timing, but surely Colapinto, because isn't it a rule that if you red flag a session, your time is deleted. So surely Colapinto's time should have been deleted unless he still had a good enough banker time to see him through. So he just deleted the last one. That's the only way I can understand it. So maybe Colapinto had at least some.
I just understand it funny because it's like there's an obvious solution, but the rules being the awkward buggers that they are preventing you from just providing this easy solution to an easy problem. But no, we cannot have this.
But the worst thing is that Behrman's time would have seen him into like P10.
Oh, yeah.
It was like a really good time and perfectly legit apart from that red flag. So it's, yeah, an annoying weekend for Haas and an equally annoying weekend for Aston Martin, where Fernando Alonso qualified 5th, Lance Stroll qualified 8th, and then they finished 11th and 15th respectively.
It was amusing because a friend of the podcast, Leo Verbs, messaged me saying, I don't like to say this, but credit where it's due, Stroll's on it this season. And I did message him back, give him a minute. And sure enough, we got to Grand Prix Sunday and normal service is resumed. Car has certainly been improved, but it is still falling apart from the Grand Prix. And Stroll, don't care. But Alonso, frustrating. That P11 must have been the most brutal one for quite a while, especially when it was his best qualifying since, I think, somewhere near the start of last year. And then for him to be less than a second away from getting a point after starting in 5th, ever so frustrating, but somewhat good progress in the right direction, at least. It's still an odd one with them because we don't know really what they're doing this year, what their aims are, or any of it. They're just waiting for Newey still, but obviously he's not even going to do anything with the car this season, so it's going to be an all or nothing year next year for them. And in the meantime, we're just going to be treated to potentially more and more frustrating situations involving getting tantalizingly close to the points and then just missing out for whatever reason. This is where Fernando Alonso goes and wins the Monaco Grand Prix, of course, but you know.
It's a confusing one because Alonso qualified ahead of Stroll, but Stroll wasn't running new parts. So,
well, I think they gave Alonso those new parts after they'd given them to Stroll. They just gave them to him later in the weekend, was my understanding of it, okay. Which also was a bit baffling because I was thinking, why not just do it at the same time and see what you could do there? Unless that it helped, but you know.
In one practice session, as they could see the difference that it was making, so they knew how to adjust setup. But
if we'd need a longer amount of time to figure out what they're up to because it's going to drive us insane.
Yeah, I mean, one lap pace was there, but the tyres were overheating a bit. You could tell in the long run of the end of the GP, then Fernando picked up puncture at the worst time. And maybe they'll get back into the fight. Maybe Hadjar will catch them. We'll wait and see. It's interesting as it all stands, but I think Isaac Hadjar on his own could be set to overtake Aston Martin as a constructor if his form continues for the next few races, which does lead us nicely into Racing Bulls. Lawson qualifies 15th, finishes 14th, and Hadjar qualifies 9th and finishes 9th.
So you say about Hadjar possibly overtaking Aston Martin as a constructor. He's only 3 points away from Yuki. If he keeps doing this, he might overtake his now sort of main rival for the Red Bull seat, if we're going to keep going down that narrative. He's been very consistent, but I would worry about putting him into the red role. It really depends on how bad things get there and if they decide to sacrifice however much of the remainder of the season they have at whatever point they make that decision to bed him into the team. And if they decide to actually train him properly in other machinery, wild idea for them, why not? But just something they might want to look into. I think nothing, and I'm already regretting saying this for future episodes, that nothing's going to happen until at least the summer break on that front, as it shouldn't, because I think by then you do have a better idea, for at least for him. I don't know about Yuki in the Red Bull, because obviously it's a few less races, but he's got all the experience of the many different years so far. But I think if you're going to do it after the summer break, so that you'll then, but then you've got to commit to actually keeping him in that seat for at least the rest of the season and all of the next year, because otherwise I don't know what the point would be. There were some comments about, oh, Red Bull will probably look at him now and go, look, it's sticking in that second team. Leave it 5 minutes, would you? Someone please don't let them do this. Right. Let Yuki figure himself out either for the rest of the season, and then in the winter break, you train Hadjar up as much as you need to in all the other machinery, And then he's at least prepared. So if he does shit the bed immediately in 26, you can say, well, at least we trained this one and we gave him more than 5 minutes of prep time before we needed him at the car. But at the moment, just, you doing what you're doing, Hadjar. You're doing better than we all probably thought you were going to do prior to the season. And I'm quite happy with you. Just keep being anonymous and keep getting on with it. That's all we need. That's going to do you wonders. Let the results speak for themselves.
Yeah, I think that's exactly what Hadjar's doing at the moment, is letting those results speak for himself. And it's a brilliantly impressive driver. I mean, he was really quite special to watch in last year's Formula 2 season. He was very exciting and dynamic to watch and had a great challenge.
It's like if you gave one of the Muppets speed and allowed them to swear.
Yeah, he's sort of what I imagine Animal would be like if he was a Formula 1 driver. Mm. Sort of that level of frenetic energy. And it's really entertaining. And he brings a lot of that to the track when he's racing and driving. It's this very dynamic, very fast-paced racing. And it's putting him up there. And when he's racing against the slightly more experienced drivers, it really shows its worth. When you look at how he fights against Lewis Hamilton, Carlos Sainz, Alex Albon, when he's sort of dicing around in that part of the field, you sort of go, he's immediately at home and immediately getting his elbows out. And that's what any racing team will be looking for in a good driver. So it's really exciting. He's getting 100% out of that RB, especially when you look where his teammate is putting it. And yeah, getting in the position to open up a gap when it came to the pit stops. He had sort of worked his way right through the order as the pit stop cycled through and wasn't able to make the full defense and hold a full gap. But
it
was...
No, just you reminded me there. I did find it hilarious that... the team radio came on for Yuki to go, he's actually behind. You've got to do everything you can to hold him up. I just thought, I know exactly what's going to happen here. He's going to go steaming past him and there's not going to be any kind of fight whatsoever. And they came up to Hadjar and there was just kind of the same thing, not in team radio, just in commentary. And I thought, yeah, it's not going to happen here. It's either going to be the best defense we've ever seen and Yuki's going to look somehow worse after the back of this, or it can be exactly the same because he's in a racing balls, come on, at the same time, be realistic. And sure enough, Piastri zooms past him again. You go, okay, we'll have a talk about that later in terms of what we mean by defense, but very amusing as a spectator to see those kind of things go there. We've got to help Max out. Hasn't happened.
Yeah, there was an interesting difference in that. But again, the fact that he's able to work his way up to that point in the grid in his rookie year and sort of he can be...
For that to be asked of him.
Yeah,
he can with be... With Yuki, fair enough. But for him, he's going, guys, I'm just trying to figure out what I'm doing here. Leave me alone. I can't be doing this.
Yeah, leave me alone to focus on a bit of my own race, please. I'm trying my damnedest here. But yeah, it's good to see that effort and that availability coming from him. Meanwhile, at Alpine, Gasly qualified 10th, finished 13th, and Colapinto qualified 16th, finished 16th.
Can't remember what the third thing was that Briatore was quoted as saying that Colapinto needs to do, but two of them were, he needs to score points and he needs to not crash. And after this weekend, you go, that wasn't a checklist, Franco. That was what not to do. Not the greatest start to come back into Formula 1, but there we go. I just think that's time to just give the team to Citroën or Peugeot and or at this point already, just let some other French people have a go with it. They can't do much worse.
Yeah, I don't think Peugeot wants to come back into Formula One because they weren't exactly great when they were last here. But
this is what I'm saying. It's like you can't do worse than what you're already doing now without me. So just take that and go, well, if it doesn't work, give it to Citroën.
We'll see. But yeah, Gasly looked quick at points as well. So again, there's definitely something in that Alpine.
I've not seen someone go quicker through the gravel.
Again, Renault and Alpine certainly have got experience when it comes to rallying, so maybe that's where the gravel ability comes from. But it's just hard to pin down what's good about this car and then trying to sort of extrapolate that.
Delivery,
yeah, maybe. But it's requiring a huge effort from Gasly to get the most from it. So small wonder it's proving to be a huge hurdle for Doohan and then later for Colapinto to overcome. It's just... it's tricky. It's a tricky.
I did enjoy the team orders to let Gasly pass as if he was going to go and do something with it. You've moved from 16th to 15th. Ooh. And you've got five places to get in a number of laps, and that's the best you're going to hope for. And let's face it, that's not happening anyway. But ambitious, but rubbish.
Yeah, it was an interesting call in that sense.
What I find with Alpine is that we expect more and get disappointed, whereas with Kick Sauber, we don't expect anything and we get more out of it.
Yes. Yeah, when it comes to Kick Sauber, both drivers are good moments this weekend, but it's such an inconsistent car, you can never truly pin down exactly what it's going to do. And I maintain they are basically earning as much wind tunnel time this season as possible to bolster 2026 and beyond. They're just going, screw it, we get the most wind tunnel time. We don't need to worry about the money. We need lots of wind tunnel. So I think that's their strategy, because, of course, we had Hülkenberg qualified 17th, finished 12th. He was in the top 10 at a few points. And Morbidetto qualified 14th. Good one-lap pace from him. Finished P18. Again, just struggling to get the most out of that car on the long run.
Yeah, like you say, Hulk looked mighty at points. It was a shame it couldn't come together for Sauber's 600 Grand Prix. But it's just nicer to see them in the mix occasionally, even though you know it's not going to last. And P12 in that is not bad. You know, when you think about some of the drivers that started ahead of him and how close he was as well to getting into that top 10 towards the end, he wasn't a million miles away. So it was just the fact that at some point Alonso will have overtaken him and he goes, what happened? And then he looks at the car and he goes, oh yeah, that's right, you're in a Sauber.
Yeah. It's annoying, especially because you're left wondering a little bit of what could Hülkenberg do in the Haas if he had just stayed.
What could he do in bloody Red Bull or a McLaren or just? He's kind of he's the new Sergio Perez in that sense of we just like one season in a top team with him just to see what he can do.
Yeah.
A what if driver. Just so annoying. I mean, he's still there. There's still time to find out what if, but I don't know where it comes from.
Yeah, I don't know when the opportunity comes, because obviously you saw when we had the really good pink Mercedes and we saw Nico Hülkenberg come in and then immediately sort of have an absolute worldie of a sort of qualifying session. You're sort of going, okay, this is a driver that's got phenomenal pace. I hope Audi brings something good to the table. That's all I can hope for, is otherwise this... very painful few seasons for Hülkenberg. Anyway, off the back of that, we ought to crown some winners and spinners. Timo, I'd like to start with your winner, please.
Got to be Lewis Hamilton.
That's a fair answer. I can't argue against you there.
I don't really have an explanation for it because I don't need one. It's just kind of the results speak for themselves.
They do. It's what you want to see from Lewis Hamilton in a Ferrari in Italy. And given Imola is closer to Maranello than Monza is, this is very much Ferrari's home race. So a good one to have a solid performance like that across the line. For me,
I know which one you'd rather win though.
Yes, yeah. Monza would be incredible to win. Silverstone would be a great one to win for Lewis, I think, as well, in a Ferrari. Mm-hmm.
Back-to-back wins in a Mercedes and a Ferrari for Lewis Hamilton. That's a story you want, isn't it?
You'd go to sleep so happy that night, I think, if you're Lewis Hamilton.
I don't think you'd go to sleep. You'd just be done.
No, you'd just be, I can't believe I've done that. Meanwhile, though, for me, my winner has to be Max Verstappen. I think this was an absolutely incredible drive. And just sort of, it was testament to why he is who he is and what he's achieved. It's one of those drives where you go, yeah, that's the race of a champion. It's not flamboyant, but it's razor sharp.
It's another Grand Prix where we know he's going to have opportunities throughout the year to do stuff like this. We just don't know where they're going to come from. We didn't expect it in Japan, for instance. And, well, maybe there is a way to find out, because Japan was obviously the last home Grand Prix for Honda Power with Red Bull wins it. 400th Grand Prix for Red Bull wins it. They've got any other significant milestones in the rest of the season that fall on a Grand Prix weekend. Maybe we should predict him to win that. That's something to look at in the future.
Well, have we got the final return to Zandvoort this year?
Possibly, if that's definitely gone. It is definitely gone, possibly.
Yeah, that's an interesting one. We could have, obviously, Red Bull's home race is going to be an interesting one.
You say one of the other American Grand Prix as a way to signal Ford coming in?
Yeah, there's all these really interesting ways that we could see something important happen.
We've based predictions off a lot less, let's face it.
We have. Let me just remind myself, when's Max Verstappen's birthday? Does that fall on a... he's the 30th of September. Is that a Grand Prix this year?
Possibly. Back here, maybe?
September 30th. No, it's just off. It's actually between race weekends.
Typical.
It's between Baku. There's an empty race week, empty weekend, and then we head to, checks notes, Singapore. So, yeah, unfortunately, no birthday race for Max Verstappen. Anyway.
Never mind. Just spinners.
Yeah, spinners. Yours, Timo.
Helping. Give it up already.
Yeah, I think it's becoming tricky to have hope for Alpine. And I say that we have friends who work at Alpine, and it you've got a feel for
them. Cadillac's hiring.
Yeah. You've got a feel for them. You've got to hope that
save yourself.
The effort to require that much optimism constantly must be shattering.
Just Williams mechanic looking over and going, first time.
Yeah, literally. First time. Yeah, they didn't have to do that this season, this weekend, which was nice for Williams at least. Meanwhile, my spinners torn between Aston Martin and Haas. Both had...
You've got to choose Aston Martin. Haas, it wasn't really their fault. No, Aston Martin kind of was.
The pace was there in the car. It was just an absolute sort of flop. They weren't able to really capitalise on it. And when Fernando Alonso can't capitalise on it, he came out of qualifying bouncing on Jovial, and then to crush that by the end of the weekend was just so painful. Yeah, anyway, we'll move to our predictions. And it's only 2 points this week, and both of them are for me. My prediction of Piastri pole and Max fastest lap came to fruition. So now I pass Ellie May, who hadn't made points.
It's very annoying with Verstappen, because Piastri had it for so long in that Grand Prix, and then at the end, I couldn't quite remember, and I looked at you, like, Max, why did you do that?
Yeah, I had to dig through the FIA documents as usual to find the fastest lap, because of course it's not awarded a point, but we still do.
They still put it on the F1 website.
Yeah, it still goes on the F1 website. It still goes on like the FIA race room. You get the rundown at the bottom. It's like fastest lap.
Well, yeah, but it just saves you having to dig through documents. It's just there on the website.
I like the documents.
Save your time.
I like the documents because I write out like all the qualifying results and all the race results. Anyway, so while I do pass Ellie May, Timo still leads, but a pointless week sees me close up. You're only 2 points ahead now, so the battle rolls on. Yeah, meanwhile, in Fantasy Formula One world, guess who forgot to take Jack Doohan out of their team? Me. So not only does that team get...
It doesn't help that the only person I was able to swap him with was Colapinto, because the budget doesn't actually allow you to get anyone decent in the car. They're like, you can have Gabriel Bortoleto. I've already got him because I ran out of money the first time. So unless you can give me him again, which I would have taken.
I think
Gabriel, so I got 0 points from Colapinto after all that. So he didn't lose any points, but he didn't give me any either, which was not helpful.
Yeah, so obviously I lost 25 points for having an inactive driver. That team also had Kimi, Esteban, so it was a resounding minus 30 points by the end of play for my hopeful heroes. Still clearly very hopeful. Yeah, so all out of hope.
Less hope, less heroes.
Not the worst, though. I checked through, and we've got a team in our league, Kiwi Burners, which still not only has an inactive, but now has an inactive Jack. They also have Gabriel Bortoleto, who scored -2 this weekend, and Esteban.
That seems cool.
Yeah. Anyway, if you listen to this and your team is Kiwi Burners, for God's sake, go and chase it, my guy. You're doing so bad. Actually, no, they're not doing badly. We'll get to them back. Get back for Imola, Panchev.
That doesn't mean continue, though, no, with your strategy. It's not a winning one.
But don't keep going with it, but it's probably still worth changing it. For Imola, Panchev's Novartis F1 team takes the win, 258 points, just ahead of Lena Racing and Adesh Racing. Credit to my girlfriend's team, Dream Pub Quiz team, tied on fifth on 222 points. And it was a good one for Ellie May's Cat Dads 2 in ninth. Timo's on the curbs, just 1 point ahead of my Mixing Pot team, bafflingly my strongest team this weekend. Ellie May's Red Bull Rejects, the highest of the podcast teams. Overall, Lando still leads, Dietigelas in second, and Carlos Villasamzigam in third, pushing my girlfriend's Big Reach team into fourth. Had she not got Ocon there, she might have been okay. Ellie May's facial hair-free outfit are in fifth, her Cat Dad's 15th, then it's my Mixing Pot in 18th, on the curbs in 29th. Kiwi Burners somehow not last. That accolade goes to Philip Schaefer's F1 main 2. Terrible news for Fernando Alonso fans. His season-long points haul in Fantasy F1 is -29. Gabriel Bortoleto this season has scored a whopping -19. Franco, after 1 weekend, has scored nothing. And Liam Lawson has scored just 1 point, while Carlos Sainz has accrued 8. So, there's some hot gossip for you to take forth if you're going to realign your teams.
The awkward thing with trying to realign any of these teams is there's that you can get rid of them, but you can't afford anyone else because they've all gone so significantly down in value that you can only rehire them if you just hire them.
Yeah.
So they're kind of screws you.
They've not made you any money yet, so you've sort of got to cling on to a few of them and hope they start to improve. It's a very strange one. Anyway, with Fantasy F1 out of the way, that brings us to the end of this review podcast for the Imola Grand Prix. We'll be back next week with a preview of the Monaco Grand Prix. In the meantime, though, Timo, any more from you?
This week, you can find over on Is It Fast or Overwatch, a series of articles coming out on Team Brazil, the scholarships that they award to up-and-coming drivers that they want to get a bit more attention to and give a bit more opportunities to in the bafflingly large world of motorsport, where it's always incredibly difficult to try and make a name to yourself. So they have a whole program, they get a bunch of entrants and applicants through, and then the winner gets to get a different prize each year. So far, you've been able to get to the Formula Ford Festival to prove yourself there, and you've been having some karting funding in the UK to help you with that. So some really nice stuff there, so a bit of a spotlight on the BEM.
Very nice indeed. And in the meantime, if you want more from me, as usual, you can pick up the latest issue of Classic Car Weekly. I recommend giving that a read. Obviously, there's the Classic Car Weekly podcast, which goes alongside it. Plus, I'm all over social media at Jesse on Cars for the usual sort of behind the scenes in the classic motorsport world, whatever I'm up to with the MG and stuff besides. That's usually Instagram, Twitter, and TikTok are the best places to find me. Otherwise, like I said, we'll be back with a preview of the Monaco Grand Prix in very short order. Thank you very much for listening, and we'll be back soon.